What do you get if you cross a major international meeting on internet governance in Brazil? With a White House report on big data, a European Court of Justice ruling on data retention, digital sensors, ID tags, and pills, oh my, and a net neutrality that's back on the agenda in the US. You get the last 3 weeks of tech and related global news and policy stories. That's what you get. Welcome back to 40ANM in 5, the weekly download of 40ANM LLC. It's Monday, May 5th, and I'm Chris Bohm. First off, this week we take you to Sao Paulo, Brazil. Just over a week ago, Net Mundial, the international meeting of internet stakeholders, concluded in Sao Paulo. The brainchild of Brazil President Dilma Rousseff, the event, which took place at Sao Paulo's Grand Hyatt, proved to be an international who's who of internet denizens, including some of its founding scientists, law and policy scholars, as well as a gathering for many of the world's most outspoken activists and press on issues of rights and freedoms online. When the intention to host the meeting was announced by Brazil late in 2013, it was unclear what status it might have. This lack of clarity as to what it was still exists, as the calendar year is already composed of many key international meetings on what are termed internet governance issues. These include the always important and widely attended annual Internet Governance Forum, which is to take place this September in Istanbul, Turkey. But what the meeting lacked, in well-understood purpose, it made up for in spectacle and activity, beginning with a host of dignitary opening remarks, including those from President Rousseff herself.
Senhores, a Presidenta da República sanciona a lei que estabelece princípios, garantias, direitos e deveres para o uso da internet no Brasil.
Bom dia a todos. Eu agradeço a pronúncia perfeita.
And with that, President Rousseff not only helped to open up the meeting, but also took advantage of the audience and dramatic moment to sign into law the Marco Civil da Internet, a piece of legislation that she had championed addressing such issues as net neutrality and privacy online. And yet her dramatic participation was nearly overshadowed by an ardent opening address only moments earlier by Nana Nwakanma, African Regional Coordinator for the World Wide Web Foundation. Her remarks were impassioned, insightful, and also infused with a plea for women and girls, particularly, to stake their claims to policy and rights issues to ensure a better environment online for all.
Ladies and gentlemen, Net Mundial, I think, is the World Cup of Internet Governance. We need a robust stadium that can hold us. That is infrastructure. We need to enjoy the game. That is participation. We should not discriminate. That is net neutrality. Everybody is free to support their team. I support Cote d'Ivoire, Ghana, and Nigeria. That is freedom. I support Brazil as long as they are not playing against Africa. Anyway, we need to be able to wear our costumes as fans, and that is diversity. And most importantly, we need to know the rules of the game and play by it. That, for me, is transparency. Just before I sit down, ladies and gentlemen, tomorrow is Girls in ICT Day. So I'm going to speak to ladies. Girls, it is up to us to seize the opportunity that the internet has given us. Let's seize it and let's rock the world. Let us get women online. Let us get us online.
The format of the 2 days of meetings was unlike many have experienced. A few key messaging panels, composed of leadership from the Net Mundial negotiating committees, and then 4 separate sessions composed of dozens upon dozens of interventions. Each intervention was a carefully crafted 2-minute speech by a representative for one of the 4 stakeholder groups attending the meetings: civil society, governments, the technical and academic community, and the private sector. Most often, these 2-minute interventions highlighted a key fact or proposed change suggested for the Net Mundial meeting's outcome document, the set of principles and roadmap text being debated and developed in real time, even as the meeting continued.
As we talk about things, first of all, there is an area of consensus, and that is the notion of the open internet. It's a topic that across the very diverse business membership, we have support, and we heard it many times today. Where there is not consensus are the notions of more prescriptive rules on net neutrality, which get into details that vary by country by country and may freeze in time innovation in different practices.
Several of the interventions were poignant, stressing elements of the global online experience that underline the divisions between the have and the have-nots.
So I'm here to tell you that we have only one telecom company in Ethiopia, which is being operated by the government. And unfortunately, people in Ethiopia are suffering of the internet access. And internet in Ethiopia is not plug and play. It is plug and pray.
In the end, the outcome document made significant statements on issues of access to the internet and representation and participation in the multi-stakeholder process that is internet governance. It also contained impassioned statements on key of-the-moment issues such as surveillance and privacy protections, and in areas where there remains little practical international consensus on such issues as net neutrality, the document emphasized what was agreed, the critical nature of an open internet, while deferring debate on other elements to the upcoming Internet Governance Forum. The question of what Netmundial was and what might be the ultimate power of its outcome document will doubtless be better understood in time. For many I spoke with here in Sao Paulo, the experience was at once fruitful and exhausting. Rarely have I had the opportunity to see so many of the Net's founders rubbing elbows in a check-in line with participants wearing t-shirts emblazoned with such messages as "Home is where the hard drive is." Or for that matter, rarely have I been a part and in the midst of so many so concerned with how words and phrases were being shaped in real time. It was unique, but seldom do unique things happen at international meetings and at this level. Was it a success? Yes. Will what was said and done there have some staying power? Probably so. Would you want to do it again? Probably not. During the week of April 8th, the European Court of Justice invalidated the European Union's 7-year-old data retention directive. Under the 2006 directive, telecommunications operators and internet service providers are expected to store traffic, location, and subscriber data for between 6 months and 2 years. Authorities are then able to access that information in order to identify who contacted whom and when, without knowing the contents of the communication in question. The directive proposed a costly warehousing of information across Europe, which at the time many advocates in Europe had argued heavily against due to its burdens on industry and customer rights. In its ruling, the court held that the directive was a wide-ranging and particularly serious interference with fundamental rights with respect for private life and the protection of personal data. By adopting the retention directive, the court found that the EU legislators had exceeded the limits imposed by the European Union's principle of proportionality, that a legislative measure not require something with negative impacts on European citizens that are disproportionate to the potential benefits. In particular, the court found that the directive failed to offer sufficient safeguards against the risk of abuse and against any unlawful access to or use of the data. Courts in Austria and the High Court of Ireland had asked the European Court of Justice to examine whether the directive was consistent with Europe's Charter of Fundamental Rights. It took this long for the court to rule, but as a result, national courts will now need to resolve local disputes in accordance with the European Court of Justice ruling. As a result of the ruling, challenges will likely now be faced in many at the national level, even where they did not exist before. Net neutrality seems to be back on the agenda in the U.S., or at least it will be, as of the FCC's May 15th meeting, when the Commission discusses an expected new proposal from Chairman Tom Wheeler. As you may recall, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit had invalidated the bulk of the FCC's former rules following a challenge by the U.S. telecom company Verizon. The differences between the 2010 rules and the new proposal are subtle, but enough to have some advocates of net neutrality up in arms. Whereas the 2010 rule prohibited unreasonable discrimination, the new rule would allow some commercially reasonable traffic shaping. As proposed, the new rules would bring back an effective ban on the blocking of traffic or the slowing down of traffic by providers. In a statement, the chairman said of the proposed new rules that, to be very direct, the proposal would establish that behavior harmful to consumers or competition by limiting the openness of the internet will not be permitted. But it would also ask whether so-called pay-for-priority traffic agreements between broadband carriers and web content providers are commercially reasonable. Those deals would allow content companies such as Facebook or Google to pay internet providers like Comcast or Verizon for smoother premium service, The Commission's plans are to watch these deals very carefully on a case-by-case basis. In related news, cable providers Atlantic Broadband, Grande Communications, and RCN are now set to add Netflix to their TiVo-powered set-top boxes for customer access and use, the first cable providers outside of Europe to offer Netflix via set-top boxes. Netflix had been in discussions regarding a potentially similar deal with Time Warner Cable before that pay TV provider's hoped-for merger with Comcast put it on hold. On Tuesday, April 29th, National Public Radio's All Things Considered reported on the development of new employee ID badges enabled with Internet of Things connectivity. The IDs, embedded with RFID and myriad sensors, would prospectively be used with new employees or other employees who had consented to their use to measure such data as location, productivity, and voice analysis to gauge a level of interest and effort in inter-employee communications. Low-powered computers equipped with an array of finely tuned sensors are already being incorporated into real-world objects that can communicate autonomously, or nearly so. But what about when those computers and sensors are introduced into the body, or body proximity? According to Forbes, scientists at Tel Aviv University in Israel and at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston are developing a pill-sized robot that would be remotely powered by an MRI machine to swim through the gut and look for the molecular signs of gastrointestinal cancer. Motorola, when still a Google-owned company, was working with a partner called MC10, which makes a tattoo embedded with sensors and an antenna. At the All Things D conference in May of last year, Motorola was previewing a means of authentication that could be worn on the skin, much like a temporary tattoo, for weeks at a time, and a pill called the Core Temp Adjustable Core Body Temperature Sensor, made by HQ Inc. in Palmetto, California, has a built-in battery and wirelessly transmits a real-time body temperature as it travels through a patient. Proteus Digital Health won a big victory in August 2013 when, after 4 years of working through the approvals process, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration granted approval for the company's ingestible sensor invention, a 1-square-millimeter device roughly the size of a grain of sand that can relay information about your insides to you and, if you choose, a doctor or a nurse. Heart rate, physical activity, stress, and sleep patterns are among the vitals monitored, transmitted, and stored. As approved, the tiny chip called Helios would transmit that information through your skin to a stick-on patch, which in turn would send the data to a smartphone application and or any other device that you might authorize. There is the potential for the chip to be used in other ways, powered differently or perhaps even remotely powered or reloaded, as in the Tel Aviv example. The chip is non-toxic, consisting primarily of magnesium and copper, and at present, it doesn't need its own battery since it generates power from the patient's own stomach acids. The makers of the employee ID badges discussed by NPR promise an analytic tool for businesses to dissect a person's workday and habits like no other measure. And for people in extreme professions like space travel, various versions of the sensor-enabled pill have been used for some time. But like the Proteus, HQ, or Motorola MC10 initiatives, what if the sensors and analytics are embedded without explicit user knowledge or consent? The result? Feedback on our habits, bodily functions, heart rate, response to conversation, and other stimuli would paint an unwitting picture of our very existence, all without our knowledge. And what if the sensor or its analytic systems are hacked? Far from simply a breach of HIPAA rules, it would be an abomination. The fine line between an innovative tool of enormous potential health and welfare benefit and the disproportionate impact on bodily privacy and related rights could potentially be easily and catastrophically breached. In this way, the innovations have in some ways left ethicists and regulators scrambling to keep up. Google CEO Eric Schmidt commented to the New York Times in June 2013 that the truly voluntary nature of taking such a pill or other systems monitors is key. This is another technology where there are wonderful options and terrible options, simultaneously, added John Perry Barlow, a founder of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. The EU had approved Proteus's device in 2010, and for the moment, the FDA has only approved the Proteus chip for use in placebo pills to be taken in tandem with real medications for treatment of tuberculosis, mental health, heart failure, hypertension, and diabetes, for instance. but Proteus does hope to gain approval for use of the digestive chip with other medicines. Proteus has not revealed its pricing or its initial customers, but it has raised greater than $100 million to fund Proteus Systems' commercial development from companies like Novartis and Otsuka Pharmaceutical. And in May of last year, in the midst of a $62.5 million funding round reported on by Reuters, Proteus added new investor Oracle. In April of this year, Proteus announced a new investment in the UK and development of a manufacturing facility that proposes to employ as many as 200 people. The Department of Homeland Security warned computer users in the U.S. last week to stop using Microsoft's web browser, Internet Explorer, as the software has a bug that could potentially allow hackers to install malicious software without the user even knowing it. The U.S. Computer Emergency Readiness Team, or U.S. CERT, alerted that all a user has to do is to view a specially created HTML document, a web page, or even a rich email or attachment for the vulnerability to be exploited. The CERT added that it is unaware of any practical solution to the problem at present. USA Today reported that users could potentially use another browser for now, Firefox for instance, or could disable Adobe's Flash plugin, which would also alleviate the vulnerability. Roughly 55% of PC computers globally run a version of the vulnerable Explorer software, and although Microsoft confirmed last Saturday to USA Today that it is working feverishly to fix the code that allows its versions 6 through 11 to be exploited, a fix as of yet has not been posted. According to an article on May 1st by the Washington Post's Craig Timberg, major U.S. tech companies have, for the most part, ended the practice of quietly and voluntarily complying with investigators' demands for email records and other online data. Driving the shift is the eagerness of industry, particularly the U.S. tech industry, to distance itself from the government in the wake of continuing disclosures about NSA surveillance of online services. Among those companies who have changed or are in the midst of changing such policies are Google, Facebook, and Yahoo. Although, as the Washington Post reports, the changing tech company policies would not impact data requests approved by the FISA court, or for that matter, national security letters, time-limited administrative subpoenas issued by the FBI that come with built-in binding gag orders. Whereas the Post highlights that many tech companies once followed a model of quietly cooperating with law enforcement, the gap between government and industry has been ever widening. The government has traditionally notified people directly impacted by searches and seizures, though not immediately, and often delayed by weeks or months after investigators entered a home or tapped a phone line. This is particularly true if the search, seizure, or tap proved of little or no use to investigators. The individual was made aware. Ironically, just 2 months prior to the first NSA surveillance revelations on June 5th of 2013, the FBI had proposed to the White House adjustments to search and seizure rules, but according to commentators appearing later that week at an event of the Congressional Internet Caucus, no change to post-tap procedure in the online world was proposed. In March, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court Judge Rosemary Collier rejected arguments made by telecom company Verizon that the NSA's continuing program of orders for call record data was unconstitutional. Judge Collier's rejection of the challenge again was in line with the FISA court's past statements and reliance by the U.S. Justice Department on the 1979 Supreme Court opinion in Smith v. Maryland. Similarly, in April, Microsoft was ordered by New York District Court Judge James Francis to hand over customer emails even though the data itself was held on a server in Ireland. The ruling was in line with recent court decisions that treat customer data, regardless of where it is held, like company papers, accessible only under subpoena. According to the BBC, law enforcement officials had argued that coordination with foreign governments through traditional treaty avenues in order to access this data would substantially increase the burden on government and seriously impede law enforcement efforts. Our next story offers a bit of a contrast. In his January 17 speech at the Department of Justice, addressing potential surveillance reforms in the U.S., President Obama also tasked senior advisor John Podesta to compile a team and complete a White House review of big data, its potential uses, policy-related concerns, and possibilities for abuse. That review culminated this past week with the issuance of an 85-page report focusing on both consumers and businesses, and also touching on a few key issues of privacy from government intrusion. The Podesta-helmed review began primarily in the midst of the NSA revelations backlash, which produced not only resentment from within the tech industry, but also demands for reform from privacy advocates from U.S. to Europe. While much of the most recent discussion of data collection and analytics has focused on dragnet surveillance by government, the report focuses on collection practices by companies like Google, Facebook, online data brokers, and online advertising companies. In the course of his review, according to the Washington Post and the reporters Tom Hamburger and Haley Tsukiyama, Podesta and his team, and on occasion the president, met with hundreds of stakeholders, including civil liberties advocates and executives from leading technology companies. In its analysis, the group was clear to recognize how big data can benefit society. But among the key policy recommendations, the report, first, recommends that the Department of Commerce take consultative steps and seek public comment on what changes, if any, are needed to the Consumer Privacy Bill of Rights proposed by the President in 2012, in order for the draft to be made into legislation and be advanced by the President. Also, the report recommends that Congress pass legislation to provide for a single national data breach standard to amend the patchwork of state laws currently governing requirements for reporting of data breaches. It is also recommended that the Office of Management and Budget work with other departments and agencies to apply the Privacy Act of 1974 to non-U.S. persons where practicable, or establish alternative policies to protect the personal information of individuals regardless of nationality. Further, the federal government's lead civil rights and consumer protection agencies will be expected to expand their technical expertise and staffing in order to identify practices and outcomes facilitated by data analytics that have a discriminatory impact, whether intentionally or inadvertently. And finally, the report recommends that Congress should finally amend the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, or ECPA, to ensure that the standard of protection for online digital content is consistent with that afforded in the physical world. It is this last recommendation that surprisingly still has some critics, despite that civil liberties and privacy groups have long ago joined forces with major tech companies like Google and Microsoft and others, urging Congress to update the relevance and protections of the nearly 40-year-old law. Despite the broad coalition of support for reform, particularly to require full warrant protections to email, regardless of whether it's held online past 180 days, the Securities and Exchange Commission is among those arguing that such a change would make investigations and enforcement far more difficult. And alas, that is all we have for you this week. You have been listening again to 40ANM in 5. For more information and for our terms of use, visit 40a-m.com. All stories for this week's download were reported by at least two online or print news sources or taken directly from relevant releases, with the exception of specific reporting highlighted this week from USA Today, Reuters, The Washington Post, and Forbes Online. Thank you, as always, for listening. 40ANM and 5 will be back with you again on Monday, May 12th. Until then, make this week and every week one to remember. And bye for now.